KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Derek Khanna of the Yale Information Society Project, formerly a staffer on the Republican Study Committee, who's going to be discussing his now somewhat infamous copyright reform memo entitled Three Myths About Copyright Law and Where to Start to Fix It. But more broadly, we're going to discuss intellectual property law reform and Derek's current efforts focusing on jailbreaking or unlocking your cell phone. The politics of IP reform is a topic of fairly regular discussion on Hearsay Culture. We have, from really the inception of the show, this back in 2006, discussed these issues with people like Richard Epstein and Larry Lessig. We've continued forward discussing copyright, patents, trade secret issues, trademark issues, with a variety of scholars, activists, technologists, people in the field over the over six-plus year history of the show. And we've discussed it from a variety of perspectives. More recently, partly in conjunction with my own research and advocacy interests, but partially because of the issues that are out there, we spent a bit more time on international law, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, and other international negotiations that focus on a variety of intellectual property law reform efforts, primarily focused on dealing with copyright and patent infringement, but also covering other issues as well. Derek, in November of last year, authored a memo entitled Three Myths About Copyright Law and Where to Start to Fix It. That memo, at least from the perspective of many people, somewhat came out of nowhere. And the result of that memo was quite a bit of discussion that there might be the possibility of having what, from the perspective of people in the in certain industries and from the perspective of Creative Commons and other forms of alternative innovation, thought might be an opening to, from that perspective, balance the law. However, that memo also was received quite negatively by other industries, entertainment, pharmaceutical, and others, who saw this memo as going against their interest. And in a depending on your perspective, not surprising, a very surprising move, Derek was not allowed to stay with RSC, and in fact was let go. As a result of that experience, however, Derek did not go into a corner and get in a fetal position. Rather, he has been very active, writing in a variety of venues. He is focused right now, as I mentioned, on jailbreaking or freeing cell phones from lockdown. He's written for publications ranging from National Review to The Atlantic. I have come across his work following the jailbreaking issues, and also through my discussions with a variety of people over the years from the Information Society Project, which I admire greatly. And we've had people on ranging from Laura DeNardis to James Grimmelman to others who've been affiliated with Yale. And so Derek's work has come to my attention, and certainly post-memo, his work is receiving much national attention. So we're going to discuss today with Derek, who is joining us via Skype from his apartment in D.C., in Washington. And we are recording this show on Wednesday, May 8th, for airing today. We're going to discuss a variety of these issues and kind of learn more about Derek's work and his interests here, where he sees some of these issues going. So, Derek, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture and taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me on. I'm really excited.
So, Derek, let me ask you the question that I ask most of the people on the show. What is the genesis of your interest in, and we'll start broadly, in intellectual property law before we drill down perhaps to the copyright issues that you've written about?
Sure. So, I mean, it's interesting is I got involved with government at a very young age because I saw us having a regulatory and a legal structure that was really inhibiting innovation, and I wanted to figure out the best way it was to proceed to fix it. And from my conception, as a conservative-minded person, I believe that the free market works best and that the federal government should relatively stay clear. And within that conception, in the Constitution, actually, it says that the federal government does have a very important role, however, in incentivizing research and development or, you know, creation of content through the copyright clause or the patent clause. And so intellectual property law is actually one of the few ways, almost in a libertarian mindset, that the federal government has to be involved. And it struck me that these rules and these laws are so poorly thought through and so infrequently reviewed that it was an area ripe for revision and intellectual inquiry.
And so talk a little bit more about that. I mean, you frame your perspective as conservative-minded. You know, as I read your work, there is, I think, a strong strain of libertarianism in it as well. But perhaps, dig a little deeper and tell us from, at least with regard to intellectual property, where the roots of your thinking derive.
Sure. I mean, so, you know, I am more of a conservative, perhaps, than a libertarian, although I'm interested in hearing a diverse array of perspectives. But yeah, I mean, it's directly in the Constitution that the purpose of these programs are to create the most amount of content, to create content. And it's just weird working in Congress that they don't even have hearings on this. I was so surprised working for Senator Brown and for the House Republicans that they weren't even at least having an annual hearing saying, you know, how are these laws doing today in this new world that we're entering, this new horizon?
And so your interest here is I think broadly, at least the way I look at it, is broadly conceived as innovation policy. And perhaps you could talk a little bit, from that perspective about, the RSC and its role in setting that standard, which will get us into a discussion of your memo.
Sure. So, you know, so I worked for Senator Brown for 2 years from Massachusetts and then, got recruited to come over to the Republican Study Committee. Frankly, because they knew I was an ideas guy, and that was my kind of thing, was trying to push the box and trying to talk about new ideas within the system, within the leadership structure. A lot of these offices are very closed down on what you're allowed to talk about and stuff like that. And so the Republican Study Committee was really known for pushing the box on conservative ideology. Now, I'm sure many of your readers wouldn't like all the things they did, and I didn't agree with all the things they did either, but they weren't scared to come out on an issue they saw as the conservative perspective. So, for example, they came out strongly against what's called the Ex-Im Bank, which is essentially a loan guarantee program specifically for Boeing, which they saw as crony capitalism, and they had a quite significant campaign on calling that crony capitalism for what it was, a special handout. And so those were the type of things that really drew me to the Republican Study Committee, was there was an opportunity to work on conservative issues and, stand up for the free market and innovation within certain mandates.
And so how much of the focus of the RSC in your time was there, focused specifically on intellectual property law? Was your work there an outlier, or was it front and center in the discussion?
So the Republican Study Committee was first and foremost a organization dealing with the debt and deficit and fiscal issues. But in the past 3-4 years, they had started to branch out into other areas. But they really didn't have that many policy staffers. So it was kind of it's a question of what the staffers wanted to work on and what you got approval from your supervisors on. And so they had never done anything ever before on intellectual property. And I started to talk about how important it was if we are serious about economic growth, how we really can't leave out discussions on intellectual property. Because if you talk to startups, at least in my conversations, the three issues that I've heard pointed out are patent law being a problem, copyright law being a problem, and high-skilled immigration being a problem. So if we're serious about economic growth and we're not talking about two of those three, and then that's a serious problem.
And so the memo itself that you authored, and we'll get into the substance of it in a moment, but I think the procedure is something that's particularly interesting here and fairly unusual. How did this memo itself come about? You mentioned that no one had done this before. Was this your idea? Was it something you were asked to do? Was it a combination? I mean, how does this process begin?
Sure. So we have we bat around a lot of ideas on, you know, bills to try to get introduced. And it was my job to come up with ideas, create legislation, find a member of Congress to introduce it, and throw it through committee. And that's what I did. And on this issue, we talked about it and we sent it out in a newsletter to all of our members saying we're interested in copyright reform, and no one responded. And at that point was when I was given the directive by my supervisor, okay, copyright reform is not self-explanatory. Why don't you write a memo on a different way to think about copyright reform that frames your argument and why we need copyright reform? And then we can send that out to all our members and staff and, try to work on this going forward. And so that was kind of the impetus of the memo, and that's why it's kind of been misreported a little bit of each, which is, yeah, the impetus of the idea was mine, but I was trying to go quietly through the system, and I was asked to write a whole report on it, a public report on it.
And so, so again, for those that aren't familiar, so when you say you wrote a memo that would be distributed to the members, who are you speaking about specifically? I don't mean names, but what kinds of people? Is it members of Congress? Is it a broader group? Who would get this memo once it's authored officially?
Sure. So all the reports that I was asked to write formally were distributed to all of our members of Congress, and all of their staffers as well. Although we heard in not a few occasions that they were actually read by members of Congress, particularly this report.
Mm-hmm. And so when the memo like this goes out, is it viewed or should it be taken as the official position of the Republican Study Committee, or is it a thought piece? I mean, how much stock can be put in the support behind whatever is in a particular memo, whether it's yours or someone else's?
You know, that's a good point. So the report, has, Republican Study Committee letterhead on it. I'm not actually listed as the author on it, which is another thing that they do to say this is more of a general perspective of the organization, although every word in it was written by me. But their traditional position is that they do not take formal positions on any pieces of legislation. But when they issue these reports, they're usually it's quite defining on where the organization is. So the Republican Study Committee may not have technically been against the Ex-Im Bank, the handout for Boeing, but they issued a report just like this that was perceived as the Republican Study Committee being against the Ex-Im Bank.
And so that's interesting. So then when a memo like this goes out, and again, I'm asking these questions for, those in the audience who are not inside DC which is a lot of people, and who don't focus on it from this, sausage making nuts and bolts perspective. It is, while it's not officially viewed this way, it is taken as the position of the RSC, meaning, and this is, I think, critical, meaning that there isn't internal debate around the issue. In other words, if a memo goes out, can the public, right, receiving this memo justifiably take from it that this is not only the position, but that it's a uniform position?
I don't think that's completely accurate. So the Ex-Im debate issue, there were a number of people in our caucus who disagree with that. But it's taken as this is a significant position of a number of members of the caucus.
And so from that perspective, right, your memo, which substantively, like as I mentioned in the introduction, is a position that's taken by a variety of people that are quite frankly not members of the Republican Party, that are often viewed as politically and ideologically very different. You titled the paper Three Myths About Copyright Law and Where to Start to Fix It. Literally, your first point is the purpose of copyright is to compensate the creator of the content as a myth, as a myth, which, again, is a controversial position, but one not generally associated, right, or at least in the public understanding, generally associated with the Republican Party. So before we even get into the substance of that issue, is that a fair statement? In other words, that perception seems to, I think, was out there. But is that accurate?
Well, so the Republican Study Committee is supposed to be a conservative organization and represent the conservative brand. So the point of putting out a report is not that it's the de facto Republican position, but it is that this should be the conservative position, just like the Ex-Im Bank. So John Boehner may have supported the Ex-Im Bank, but the point was that real conservatives should not have supported the Ex-Im Bank, and that ultimately resulted in a change of that law. So similarly here, by putting out the report, it's a statement that the real conservative position is that we need to take a analytical look towards copyright. And in fact, that is the historical norm. And, you know, with the Sonny Bono Act and previous extensions in history, it was conservatives and Republicans who were saying, well, hold up here. Let's go back to the Constitution. This is not, strictly speaking, consistent with those aims. Rather than the Democrats, which have traditionally been more closely related, organized with the Hollywood contingency.
Mm-hmm. And so are Republican, or is the Republican Party, or is Republicanism, as you see it, synonymous with conservatism? In other words, without getting too far into the history of the Republican Party, that hasn't always been the core position or the core view of the Republican Party. I mean, if you go back into the world of Rockefeller Republicans and others, right, there might be a broader range of opinion. And so is that the current conception in your view, or generally speaking, of what the Republican Party is and then therefore what the Republican Study Committee should represent?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But it's – okay, so the term conservative and liberal – are an ideology, and Republican and Democrat are a party. So the party is fallible. The party can elect stupid people. The party can have people say dumb things that don't really represent that ideology. The point is the ideology is supposed to remain intellectually coherent. So Republicans have traditionally been associated with conservatism, and it's similar to saying, you know, liberal versus Democrat. Not every Democrat would associate as a liberal, but the conservative brand has now basically taken over the Republican Party. Most Republicans say they are conservatives. So basically the point is that the real true – if you are a real Republican, then you're a conservative, and the conservative position has historically been these reforms, that copyright should be looked at through this prism.
Now, as has been well reported, there was significant blowback to this memo, and just, you know, to close the ring on the politics and then focus on the substance. Where, from your perspective, what was the impetus behind the blowback, and how would you describe the blowback?
You know, it's one of those things I haven't really talked about on the record, but there were some who reached out. There were some who were very angry. But I gotta tell you, I had a lot more Republicans and conservative groups who were strongly in favor. So it was very surprising that a small, vocal, non-conservative minority was able to supersede a majority of conservative organizations and members.
Obviously you can feel free to not answer these questions. You want to name names of any surprising entities that were either, you know, at least surprising to you, were for or against the substance of the memo?
I'm not going to do that. And I'll tell you why is I still have a lot of great relationships across the Hill, particularly with Republican Study Committee members that I worked for before and who supported the memo when it came out and support the reforms today. And I work with their staff and them personally, and so I'm not going to personally identify any of them. I'm hoping to be able to work with that going forward for positive change.
No, and I understand that. One last question on those politics. Again, you know, obviously you have the caveat across the board to not answer the questions. In terms of the memo making its way out, did you have a sense when the memo was officially put out there that there would be this kind of blowback? Was there any discussion internally that would suggest, you know, where anyone said to you, hey, Derek, you know, be aware that this is explosive or this could be problematic, or did it come out of, you know, the proverbial left field perhaps irony intended, from your perspective?
Not exactly. I mean, I had actually told my office that this was going to be controversial, and I thought this was the right way to proceed, but that this was going to be inflaming certain interest groups, and I told them who they were. And as I said before, the Republican Study Committee was not scared to take on interest groups, and in fact, they had even taken on interest groups with Republican leadings. You know, the Ex-Am Bank was supported by lobby groups that have good relationships with Republicans, and they still took it on. So I laid out to my office, you know, these are the groups who are going to be calling. These are the groups who are going to be angered. These are going to be their arguments. This is what they're going to say. These are the members of Congress who are not going to be happy with this. And in fact, when I wrote the memo, I wasn't allowed to get peer review. I wasn't allowed to shop it around because they were worried that that it would leak and that people would get, you know, on the special interest side would try to kill it. And so I had people at my level read the document. I had our legislative director sign off and revise the document. And they said, you're good to go. You can send it out. And I said, I'm not going to put out this document unless I have our executive director personally read and revise it. And he had never read. He doesn't read these type of documents. My point was, I wanted everyone in the organization to know what we were getting into, what this meant, and what the stakes were. And that's what I told him. And he asked, you know, are there any Republican, are there members of our caucus who agree? Are there conservative organizations who agree with your perspective? And I said, absolutely. And he said, well, it seems like the conservative perspective to me. And so it's, I think we should send it out.
We're chatting with Derek Hanna of the Yale Information Society Project, former staffer on the Republican Study Committee on KZSU-FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. So Derek, the transition into the substance as a result of this memo being out there and based upon the fact that you do want to use the memo, to establish positive, communications, at least so far, and it's been now 5 months or so, 6 months since it was released. Have you seen at least that is occurring or will occur? How much success have you had in opening up doors, without naming names, and I respect that, with entities that you would like to have those relationships with?
Well, I mean, the reception was just overwhelming in a positive direction, even on the Hill. I mean, the night the memo went out, I was up till about 2 in the morning working with staffers. Some of their bosses wanted to move on this very quickly. And it was really a unfortunate situation when the Republican Study Committee decided to take it off their website and back away in the way they did, although they never formally retracted or, they never formally condemned or retracted it. But a lot of members of Congress, they didn't even think of these issues. And this has given us a door to work on these issues going forward and to continue working on them in the long haul. And so now we have the Registrar of Copyright who came out and endorsed in principle some of the reforms I talked about here. And now we have Chairman Goodlatte having a series of hearings talking about many of the issues I talked about here. And the reason is not that I am some sort of a Nostradamus, but I was taking a consensus of some of the reforms that were already on the table and trying to put forward in an articulate conservative argument.
And do you think that the memo itself is a direct impetus for the hearings, which have now been recently announced, and a sudden broad discussion, really over the last week or two, from policymaking circles on taking a close, hard look at copyright law, perhaps in the way that patent law was recently, at least in terms of procedure, the way the patent law was reformed in the American Invents Act?
It would probably be improper for me to speculate, but it does seem like there's a lot of continuity in these ideas, and that these ideas were not really on Republican radar before.
Mm-hmm. Well, Derek, let's do this. Let me do my my public service announcement now, and then we're going to go into the substance of your memo. Again, you're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, and we're talking with Derek Hanna of the Yale Information Society Project, a fellow former staffer for Republican Study Committee. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You You have a couple of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture and listen to KZSU. There's a couple of ways you can donate to KZSU. You can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Either way, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So, Derek, let's talk, turning away from the politics, although we may close on it, let's turn to some of the substance of this memo. Like I mentioned, it's titled Three Myths About Copyright Law and Where to Start to Fix It. And you identify three primary myths, in your view. The purpose of copyright is to compensate the creator of the content is myth one. The second, copyright is free market capitalism at work. And three, the current copyright legal regime leads to the greatest innovation and productivity. You've mentioned that you wanted to write this from the perspective of what a conservative, from your perspective, a Republican would say about copyright law. But let me take a step back and ask you this question.
Go
ahead. Yeah.
That is how I have conceived copyright. It wasn't I was trying to articulate through those arguments. I was trying to, this is my perspective. I'm a conservative and I support copyright reform and this is the conservative argument.
Okay, fair enough. So from that perspective, taking a step back, the conservative viewpoints as you see them have not been reflected in copyright law to date. Why?
I think they're definitely starting to be. I mean, for years, since the Sonny Bono Act, there's just been, I mean, everyone went away. There was just the MPAA, Chamber of Commerce has been able to frame the debate and say copyright should exist forever, and it's just like any other property, and et cetera, all those type of things. And therefore, we should even have an intellectual discussion about it. How long should copyright be? Forever. How absolute should it be? Absolute. What should be the statutory damages? As much as we want. But today, now we're starting to have actual conversations, and people are starting to say, show me the data, and we're starting to have hearings in the House and say, bring in the experts. All those things are actually evidence that conservatives are coming around to these perspectives. Conservatives are looking through this stuff through the prism of what is effective policy, which means that we are winning.
But I guess, even agreeing that that's happening, I'm curious if you take, the step back 10 years, right? So you talk about the Sonny Bono Act, which extended the duration of copyright to, in many cases, over a century. Or you talk about other extensions of copyright duration. Or you talk about, efforts to attempt to make it much more or much easier for plaintiffs to bring actions involving copyright infringement. Why is it that at times where conservative viewpoints did have currency, that copyright law wasn't necessarily going in that direction? I'm asking you really to take a look back and if you have a perspective on why that hasn't happened until now.
Sure. I mean, so there's been a public information campaign, by the content industry, which has been saying, basically this is real property, and, just the prevalence of the term intellectual property has become pervasive. So there's been a very sustained campaign on these issues. At the same time, there's been a, information campaign that piracy is an epidemic that's destroying the industry, and that may or may not be true, but that really is an omnipresent threat on Capitol Hill for at least the past 5-10 years. And so that makes, whenever you're adjusting copyright law, you have to deal with the issues of piracy. That's what I got thrown at with me is, oh, you just support piracy. Well, no, I don't support piracy. See, nothing in here supports piracy. And so that's kind of, they've been able to kind of control the dynamic of the debates, which is these conservative, law and order perspective, the conservative, this is property, and Republicans believe property is inviolable. So they've been able to kind of take some of the talking points and put it on their territory.
And so when you, in the memo itself, when you talk about these issues, and you spend, you spend the bulk of the time, the bulk of the writing, at least in the memo, on the third point, that where you say the current copyright regime leads to the greatest innovation and productivity, and with that you get into a detailed discussion of copyright duration. The clause in the Constitution, which is relevant here, of course, as you point out, is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, which refers to granting copyrights for a quote-unquote limited time. And, of course, that's been an issue that has already been litigated and in large measure decided by the Supreme Court in the Eldred opinion, which effectively said that everything that Congress has done up to now is a limited time, because as long as there is a temporal limit, roughly speaking, it works. You point out, though, and it's something which is interesting, because the argument isn't often framed this way. You say on page 4 of your memo, today's legal regime of copyright law is seen by many as a form of corporate welfare that hurts innovation and hurts the consumer. To be clear, when you use the phrase corporate welfare, what do you mean in this context? How is copyright law, in your view, corporate welfare?
Sure. So, I mean, those type of terminology are actually similar terminology to what Stuart Baker had said, who was assistant secretary of National Security Agency, now a very prominent lawyer. So this is not entirely just Derek Hanna's argument, but it is a system of corporate welfare, just like the Ex-Im Bank was a system of corporate welfare. When you are using the instruments of governmental power in order to sustain an old market model and keep out new market participants, particularly when you're co-opting the legal system, I think that's really the most dangerous and scary, is when you're able to rewrite the laws and say that people should go to jail or that individuals should be liable for billions of dollars in damages, when under common law they wouldn't have been liable for billions of dollars in damages. So when you're able to do that, that is a system of corporate welfare, which is that you are underwriting the costs of economic theft. And, you know, the reality is that, I worked in retail for a few years. It was the worst experience of my life. I advise everyone to avoid it. But working in retail, I saw, you know, shoplifting is pervasive. In every retail store you go into, there's a sign that says, this is our shrink rate. This is how much merchandise is going to go out the door. But at the same time, those retail stores aren't turning to Washington, D.C. and saying, hey, we have lots and lots of shoplifting. We would really appreciate it if we got some corporate welfare here, because, you know, shoplifting is going to destroy America. And that's kind of some of the arguments that we're hearing on piracy, which is, yeah, piracy is real. I agree piracy is real. But does that justify indefinite copyright? Does that justify using the billions of dollars of DOJ assets to arrest average people? Not necessarily. And that's how it's a form of corporate welfare, when you're able to subvert the system and curry out benefits to your favor and actually harm your competitors and harm new market models.
So with that perspective, and getting back to this temporal limit, does the corporate welfare issue rise to the level where it's a concern because of the fact that the duration, is, of copyright is so long? In other words, would there be, and if we return, as you write in the memo, if we return to the original, by original meaning literally the founder's conception of copyright, of 14 years, would that diminish or eliminate copyright as a corporate welfare privilege?
Well, I'm not necessarily advocating going back to the 14 years, but to the extent that copyright is significantly longer than what is necessary to create the incentive for the content creation, you are harming the public by taking those works perpetually out of the public domain and ensuring that those works can't be, eventually remixed and turned into new works. And so that's what I mean by corporate welfare. But in addition, you know, these laws are so pernicious in the context of cell phones, which we'll talk to a little bit later. They actually define what technologies are lawful for average Americans to use and make other technologies punishable by up to 5 years in prison. And so those systems have been able to be co-opted by, you know, completely different market participants for their own corporate welfare, the cell phone companies in particular. So when you have laws that allow for you to ban technologies, or you have laws that say, you know, this content can never be publicly available, that's a form of corporate welfare, because you're creating a government-created monopoly, and you're a government-enforced and created monopoly.
But isn't it true, to push back a little bit, because I understand your point, but wouldn't it be true even if the monopoly lasted a day?
Sure, but I mean it's in the Constitution that you have a necessary system to create the incentive. But to the extent that you're keeping it much longer than the incentive, I would justify that as a form of corporate welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And to be clear, you know, you bring up a good point about the Supreme Court case, but really, you know, conservatives and libertarians have a different conception of what is constitutional than what the Supreme Court says. So the Supreme Court is really supposed to be saying, like, look, this is well beyond the pale. And the best example is the death penalty. So the Supreme Court may look at the death penalty and say, well, wait a second, you know, this is pretty heinous, but is this cruel and unusual punishment? It's a difficult argument for the Supreme Court to make because they had the death penalty in 1781, 1776, etc., and at the time, whatever the Bill of Rights was, in 1786. So, you know, is it under the original intent cruel and unusual? It's difficult for the Supreme Court to make that decision, but you know, modern society should be interpreting the Constitution through the prism of their legislatures. Their legislators are supposed to be saying, you know, what does this actually mean for us? And so when the Constitution says it must be limited, you know, as Jack Valenti has famously said, you know, head of the MPA before, to me that means infinity minus a day. Well, that may fly by the Supreme Court, but any member of Congress should say, no, Constitution says limited. Our founding fathers interpreted limited to be 14 years. Limited does not mean 500 years. And that's a different constitutional deliberative process that Congress should be engaged with, and that's the argument here.
And I do want to talk about cell phone jailbreaking in a moment, but a couple more points with regard to the memo. You know, again, under this heading of myths, you refer to the impact on scientific inquiry, which is one also that you know many in the you know open access world share. You make references there to you know the idea of the locked vault, and I guess to get you know to continue on this point of corporate welfare, but also of locking information down. What do you see as the conservative viewpoint on the sharing of knowledge, right? So with regard to scientific inquiry, the notion of the locked vault, what do you see there as the conservative position with regard to those issues?
Yeah, so I mean, it's pretty complicated. Basically, if you wanted to research whatever you research and you create, you know, your new patent on fusion and you don't want to use your patent on fusion even though you've cracked fusion, the conservative argument is that you put the sweat and equity into it, you should be able to do whatever you want with it. But at the same time, if you have government research and you created this research, you know, paid for by the U.S. government, well, that should be publicly available. That information should be learned by everybody. That's a conservative perspective, is if we're paying for it, we should be able to benefit from it. And as far as, you know, like law journal articles or scientific articles, what I was referring to was many people have written articles in, you know, the 1930s, 1925, wrote law journal articles, wrote, scientific experiments, etc. None of them were expecting to be having those behind locked vaults forever. And in fact, as somebody who's written law journal articles, you often don't get compensated at all, and so you would rather have those works be publicly available. And so the idea that, you know, law journal articles from the 1925 or, scientific experiments from 1925 should be behind these locked vaults, it doesn't make that much sense because no one's actually going to go back and find them. So no one's actually going to be compensated for those works. It really is a dead weight loss on society and the economy. But if you were to make those works publicly available after a reasonable period of time, which is the original intention of the Constitution, then there'd be an economy for me to benefit from my work and my publication. And then after that 14, 28, 48 years, whatever, then it's publicly available. And what we find is that when works enter the public domain that are old, viewership actually goes up significantly, sometimes 500%. So if you're a professor, you would actually want your work to be cited and to be widely read and distributed. So it really is a good thing for scientific inquiry and for, you know, the involved participants. It actually creates more of an incentive.
We're chatting with Derek Cotta of the Yale Information Society Project, and author of the memo, Three Myths About Copyright Law and Where to Start to Fix It, on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So last question on this memo, Derek, and then I want to transition to discuss your current work on cell phone jailbreaking. The last italicized sentence of your memo says, current copyright law does not merely distort some markets, rather, and again, you know, I'm a textualist, so I wanted to point out the italics. Doesn't merely distort some markets, rather it destroys entire markets. What entire markets are being destroyed, in your view, by copyright law as it stands today?
Sure. I mean, so I don't name them specifically in here, but I can name a few directly offhand. You know, the entire remix market in this country is completely stymied. You know, in other countries, you see a thriving market of remixing, you know, songs and works. And in this country, we have some of the top-performing DJs to perform live. But, you know, if they want to record those remixes and they use, you know, a single beat from another song, you know, they're going to have to pay $150,000 for those remixes. So, effectively, you know, there is no mom-and-pop DJ remix market that is lawful. And so that's an entire market that could be thriving. And, in fact, we should be the world leader in that market. We create most of, or almost all the... I shouldn't say that. Probably the Asian markets create more music, but we create a lot of music. And the idea that we don't also have this remix market, which is quite profitable, particularly in Europe where they are, you know, voracious consumptions of that, that's the entire market that's being destroyed. Another market is, again, because our copyright laws are so pervasive that they have sometimes nothing to do with incentivizing content. They actually define what technologies are lawful. There's whole categories of technology that Americans can't use. There are adaptability technology for the deaf and blind that's illegal. You know, that could be a profitable industry. You know, it could even be paid for out of insurance if it's useful enough. So there's all these markets. The last one I'll mention is the phone unlocking market, which again is another technology that's unlawful, and jailbreaking is unlawful. So those are entire markets that could exist, but those are, of course, not the only markets. And you talk to Brad Burnham with Union Square Ventures. He says he doesn't even invest in companies that deal with copyright because they don't know what the law is. That is, you know, destruction of innovation. We see today Aereo being sued for billions of dollars because the law is so unclear there. In one court, it's a $1 billion company. In another court, it could be a $1 trillion liability. And, you know, I've been working with a whole bunch of startups that are being sued by Craigslist. That's been complete copyright fraud. Craigslist is claiming they have copyright to users' posts. They don't. They're claiming that these other websites are infringing upon that copyright. It doesn't. And a court concluded that. But still, they're using copyright as a weapon because they're saying, you know, we think you violate our copyright and you're liable for $14 trillion in damages. That's not how you have an efficient market. An efficient market requires actualized damages. So that way, if Craigslist says, yes, you're violating our copyright, they have to prove that, and, you know, you have an actual litigation process. So that's what I mean by, you know, destroys entire markets, is when you create these massive thresholds, no one's going to enter that market uncertainty.
So Derek Cotta, of the Yale Information Society Project and formerly of the Republican Study Committee. Let's turn our attention now, and by the way, what I call the unfair portion of the show, which is when I start asking questions that you might not have enough time to answer as thoroughly as you'd like, but I reserve the right to do it, and I will. You have worked very recently. You've written several pieces and given talks about the problems associated with unlocking your smartphone. So as the transition here, why don't you give us the and many listeners may be familiar with the issue, but for those that aren't, the kind of one-minute overview of the issue and how copyright law, and particularly in this case the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, impacts that issue.
Sure. So the Digital Millennium Copyright Act passed in 1998. In Section 1201 in particular, it says that any attempt to circumvent digital protection schemes is basically illegal. And as you know, technology has progressed since 1998, which of course was well before, you know, the Kindle and iPhone. Basically, all media consumption has come after the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is just, this is obvious why we should be updating it. All media today consumption comes on devices that qualify under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and even like printer cartridges and other you know car parts that you would never expect potentially come under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, although those are a little bit of a legal mixed bag. And so the Digital Millennium Copyright Act regulates what you can and cannot do with those technologies because effectively, these digital protection schemes are built into everything today. So if you want to use these technologies for purposes that the manufacturer did not originally intend, that requires you going around these protection schemes, which are basically you know, script kiddie easy to go around. But once you go around it, then you've broken a law. So if your manufacturer of your phone does not want you to unlock your phone and you choose to unlock your phone anyways because it's your property, that is called a circumvention, and that circumvention is not approved of by the Librarian of Congress, and it is illegal, punishable by potentially 5 years in prison.
And so the issue as it stands today is one that has it received a good amount of attention when people like Jonathan Zittrain wrote about these issues, but also Stephen Levy a few years ago wrote kind of an opposite view, not with regard to this issue particularly, but he wrote a book a few years ago called The Perfect Thing, I think it was. I had him on the show discussing it. The smartphone industry, of course, takes a position that generally speaking that these products are really part and parcel of their intellectual property, and therefore they have the right to control how you use it. Again, going back to the theme we had of the show of the conservative position, how is that not a conservative position with regard to a product that someone puts in the market?
Well, it's kind of humorous, actually, anyone with intellectual integrity, which is, you know, they're saying that intellectual property and copyright's the exact same thing as real property. When it's not, our founding fathers rejected that position. But at the same time, and therefore it should be inviolable, it should last forever. But at the same time, they're saying when you buy your iPod or your Kindle or your phone, that you don't actually own it, that it's not actually your property, that the manufacturer retains effectively ownership rights over that device perpetually. It's completely intellectually incoherent and disingenuous. The conservative perspective is that real property is, as I said, inviolable. You buy your phone, you own that phone. Aside for a second, the question of whether or not you have outstanding payments, or that's a separate question. But if you buy your phone, you own your phone. You should be able to do whatever you want with it. And people who say separately, that's just not the system of law we have in this country. I mean, there are other systems of law that have moral rights. France is a good example. They believe in France that when you buy a sculpture, you cannot change that sculpture or paint that sculpture because that artist perpetually owns that art. But that's just not the system we have in this country. When you buy your phone, if you want to throw it against the wall, you can do that.
And so where do you see, in terms of the legislative efforts here, where do you see things heading in terms of addressing this issue? Where does it stand now, and where do you expect it to go?
Sure. So, I mean, I had, you know, the whole campaign and a whole bunch of articles on it, and trying to really frame the debate correctly because the content industry is trying to frame this as, you know, a bunch of people who don't want to pay their bills and who are fighting against the man, which is really kind of simple. It was silly because it's a property rights argument. But, you know, after the White House came out and endorsed it, the FCC announced investigation, we got about 6 bills introduced in Congress. They're far from perfect. None of them seem to be having very much traction right now. I think it's starting to get wrapped into the issue with Chairman Goodlatte's hearings, which is that Goodlatte wants kind of a broader copyright reform, and I think Section 1201 reform has to be part of that bucket.
So, Derek, as we think about these issues even more broadly and going on the international stage, you've expressed concerns in a few pieces I've read with regard to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and that's an area that I've focused on heavily from a procedural standpoint, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement being a trade agreement being negotiated by the U.S. Trade Representative with about 10 or 11 countries right now that has apparently a significant intellectual property rights chapter. However, the text of those agreements are not public. The only information we have are based upon leaks, and those leaks are at this point probably out of date. Again, broadly speaking, what are your thoughts on the secrecy of the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations?
I mean, there's just no need for it. It's unbelievable. And, you know, as someone who worked on the Hill, as somebody who worked on these issues, as someone who got tried to get access to the data, it was, you know, cloak and dagger stuff. I would talk to members of Congress and they'd say, yeah, I really shouldn't, I should talk to you about this, but, you may want to know this about the bill. And it's just like, this is preposterous. This level of secrecy, it may make sense in the context of, you know, the START Treaty, which is regulating nuclear weapons. But, the idea that, you know, this treaty on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, it can only be read by members of Congress. It can't be read by their staffs. And so members of Congress have to go in under a closed procedure. They have to show up and they can't take it back to their offices. The reality is that most members of Congress don't have the time and they would like to delegate this to their members, to their staff members. But the idea that they would not only read it once, but stay on top of it through recent developments. I mean, it's designed to avoid, transparency. And it's very dangerous, particularly for conservatives. I mean, intellectual property law should be defined by what your economy needs today in 2013. I mean, that's just basic. So the idea of codifying that into an international treaty yet again is a terrible idea. And there's really no need for it. And, you know, it's baffling. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty is very dangerous. And, you know, I'm a big free market guy. I'm sure I would love most of the treaty. But the idea that it's going to lock in intellectual property law forever is really an unfortunate one and potentially one that could kill the treaty to begin with.
You know, the pushback there, and it's something that I have encountered directly in my own work on these issues and projects I'm working on now to address it. The pushback generally is, well, and this is the pushback coming from representatives, the U.S. Trade Representative and others that have been involved in trade negotiations. The response with regard to secrecy is we need that secrecy in order to effectively negotiate. So if we do it publicly, people will not give their real positions. We won't be able to do the horse trading, and therefore we won't get a deal. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's some need for secrecy and individualized details, but no one's talking about. I mean, there has been nothing provided by the White House here on what, you know, what's on the table, what they're taking a look at. That's what I mean. Is they don't have to say, you know, we're talking about life plus 70 versus life plus 90. Maybe you can make that argument, but they haven't even acknowledged that intellectual property is really on the table here, or if a DMCA issues are going to be on the table here. And how can you legislate in Congress if you're talking about wholesale copyright reform and you don't even know what may or may not be locked into international treaty? So I just don't buy that argument, and I know who's at the table, and the content industry has been running the table, and it's very dangerous. Particularly when you're talking about what technologies Americans can be arrested for using, being in international treaties. And again, the American conception of copyright law is a uniquely American conception in comparison to Europe. So the idea that we're going to internationalize our copyright laws further is a further deviation from what the Constitution's true intent is.
Which, to be clear, again, coming full circle, is what, from your perspective?
So the founding fathers rejected the idea that copyright is a natural right. That's very clear. In Britain they rejected that, in the United States they rejected that. They rejected that throughout the colonies because the colonies had their own copyright laws that rejected it. They rejected that in the Constitution, and the Supreme Court has rejected that a number of times. So in the United States we have a system of congressionally created copyright, which I support, but it's congressionally created property. And in Europe, they, not in all countries, but particularly in France and several other countries, they believe in moral rights, you know, a natural right type of argument, that copyright exists forever, that it can't be curtailed, that it exists and precedes the government. That's just a difference of opinion. But the idea that we're going to just adopt their perspective, is wildly inconsistent with our history.
Derek Khanna of the Yale Information Society Project, as well as former staffer of the Republican Study Committee. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture, for taking the time today. You can look for Derek's talks at a variety of places, his writing from everywhere from National Review to The Atlantic. But I thank you for joining us today and taking the time to talk about these issues. And I invite you back as this discussion progresses, if you would like to continue our discussion.
Terrific. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm excited to mention several guests coming up in the remaining days in this quarter on KZSU's schedule. Coming up next week, Oliver Day from the new nonprofit Securing Change. Securing Change is designed to offer web security services to entities that couldn't otherwise afford it, like nonprofits. I should say, by way of disclosure, that I am on the board of Securing Change, and I'm very excited about the project. So Oliver will be on. The following week, Dr. Virginia Crisp, a lecturer at Middlesex University on Kin.com and copyright infringement. Ellen Broad, Executive Officer for the Australian Digital Alliance, and closing out the quarter in the beginning of June, Susan Chalmers, the Policy Lead of Internet New Zealand. I also have a number of guests that I've lined up for the, amazingly, I am now booking guests for July and August. Among those guests will be Professor Vance Ricks, of Guilford College, Ron Epstein, the CEO of Epicenter IP Group on patent non-practicing entities, which are also known as patent trolls, Phil Napoli, a professor at Fordham University on algorithms and media, Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law School on 3D printing, Professor James Moliterno of Washington Lee Law School on technology and legal education, as well as Professor Michael Rich, my colleague at Elon, on criminal acts and technologies designed to limit them. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen live Wednesdays, 9 a.m. Pacific time on KZSU, or stream live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also pick up the show via podcast by going to either the CIS Center for Internet Society's iTunes page in the iTunes search engine. You can also go to the webpage for the Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Or lastly, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 180-plus shows as well as the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you very much for joining today. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.